This is Julie Christie. It's the 16th of September. I'm at Spears Point Library and I'm interviewing Noel Lyon about his experiences during World War II at Rathmines Air Base. Good morning, Noel.
Good morning, Julie.
Noel, you served at Rathmines during World War II, but that wasn't until 1944. What were you doing before that?
Now, before that, at age 18 and a week or two, I applied for service in the RAAF as aircrew with a preference for wireless air gunner because I was interested in radio and wanted a chance to shoot at the Japs.
What job did you have?
I was a pickler in a galvanising hot dip. Galvanising works. Now the pickler handled the steel stanchions that needed to be galvanised, that is zinc coated, in weak sulfuric acid, very large vats of weak sulfuric acid, which meant that although I was wearing gloves, quite often I'd have to dip my arms deeper to handle the steel stanchions so that some acid leaked into the gloves. Now, that meant that my perspiration would, that meant that my hands touching any material, cloth or whatever, would leave a stain, which meant that in dancing, I needed to wear a pair of gloves so that I'd not stain my partner's frock. Now, when I volunteered for aircrew in the RAAF, working in that particular industry and soon afterwards, actually a couple of months, I was called up for national service and told that I was working in a protected industry, which meant that also I would not be eligible to join the Air Force. So what I did to gain entry into the Air Force was to antagonise the owner of the galvanising works by complaining about the amenities in the works. All we had was a tap just outside the back door of the shed over a drain. Now, by complaining twice to the industrial authority in Brisbane, that did not endear me to my employer. However, despite that, my application for aircrew carried the signature of our manager as a recommendation, so that he certainly encouraged me. Now, when 6 months after I applied for service, I was called up for training. I had no problem whatsoever from our works manager.
Noel, you were born in Brisbane.
Yes, in a southwestern suburb, Sherwood, on the 10th of November 1923. Soon afterwards, in fact, at age 2 years, 8 months, my mother died of kidney failure, which in those days was known as Bright's disease. And then soon after my mother's death, my father was able to put me in the care of a Presbyterian home for children, which had been started a short time previous. At first there were both boys and girls there. One particular girl cared for me. Her name I've forgotten, but in that particular home we had a matron and her husband and two maiden ladies we knew as auntie, plus the kitchen staff, a lady cook and her helper. Now, older boys in that establishment looked after the grounds. There were several cows supplying milk for the home. There were several vegetable gardens and fruit trees, so that we were well served there. Now, that particular home, they were very beautiful people. Now, my father remarried not long before my 10th birthday, and took me home with him and my stepmother, who was quite a nice young lady, and we lived there in Sherwood until I joined the Air Force. Before applying for aircrew in the RAAF, I had served a month in the Air Training Corps in Brisbane. That was an establishment for 17-year-old lads to gain training before actually entering the Air Force. There, we learned Air Force etiquette, we attended parades, we learned the Morse code. In that period, a neighbour's boy my age with me had built a one-valve radio set, so that I then had some knowledge of radar, was interested and frequently practiced the Morse code. You could often hear me da-da-da-dit and all that sort of stuff, etc., etc., muttering it under my breath, so that very quickly I learnt the Morse code. And for that reason, as well as wanting a shot at the Japs, I volunteered for aircrew as a wireless air gunner.
You were called up on the 23rd of May 1942?
Yes, and was sent to Sandgate, another Brisbane suburb, for initial training. That was number 3 ITS. Now, there we learned Air Force etiquette. We attended drills, learned a correct way of saluting an officer. We attended aircraft identification classes, especially Japanese aircraft, because we would need that as aircrew. And at Sandgate, my first experience of tent living occurred there. But radio and gunnery were taught at different schools. The first was at Maryborough Wireless Air Gunners School, where the beginning of our training occurred with radio transmission and reception with some difficulty, because we used motor panel vans up and down the coastal road from Maryborough, which meant that with quite a lot of bumping on the road, it was very difficult to keep the radio on frequency. So that actually when I finished the 6 months training needed there, I had to do one extra month because I had not yet there I first was quite adept in radio theory, but of course with those difficulties not very good at practical radio use. So that in fact after the 6 months training I was forced to do another month to get up to speed in radio. From there I was transferred to a bombing and air gunnery school in Evans Head. There, even there, it was very difficult. We flew in a ferry battle aircraft, an ancient British aircraft, two gunners in the aircraft would take turns with one particular very old-fashioned gun.
Was it gas-operated?
A gas-operated gun, yes, which jammed here, there and everywhere quite often. And there again, because I had not reached a sufficient accuracy standard, on our pass-out parade day, I had to do one extra flight to qualify. Now, from the gunnery school, I was posted then to embarkation depot in Melbourne, expecting to be transferred to Canada for training for the European theatre in Britain. But that was stopped and cancelled because of Japanese submarine activity in the Southwest Pacific, and I was posted to sail in Victoria to train on Beaufort bombers. Now there, however, I was unable to get crewed up and was posted then on to Bairnsdale as a staff wireless operator. Also in Victoria, in a navigator's reconnaissance training school as a staff wireless wireless operator, where we flew Avro Anson's. Now, I remember one particular flight returning from the navigator's exercise. My favourite pilot, Sergeant Kusky, allowed me to fly the aircraft for about a quarter hour, and I did very well, actually. I actually felt the movement of the aircraft by what is called flying by the seat of my pants. Now, from Bairnsdale, I was posted to Rathmines Flying Boat Base. I had no idea what a flying boat was or where Rathmines was, but I very soon found out.
That was in April 1944?
Yes. And of course immediately I discovered that what a flying boat was. It was a boat that could fly, if you can understand that, and they were painted black. I soon learned why they were black instead of camouflage colours. It was because we would be flying in the squadron at night, especially dark nights, and that would mean it would be extremely difficult for the enemy to see us. I have no memory of the day-to-day routine at Rathmines, but my flying log does help me to understand what I did. We certainly practiced aircraft identification, and especially Japanese aircraft, that would be essential. We practiced radio work. We practiced some gunnery work also, both especially in from air to ground. But one particular unique test that our instructor had that was somewhat pretty nearly equivalent to air-to-air gunnery work was with a clay pigeon chute. Now, and that would be using a shotgun. So from the shore out over the lake, he would get a group of us, perhaps five of us, and we would have three shots each at the clay pigeon, which of course is a disc thrown with a catapult into the air. Now that meant that instinctive judgment was needed of the flight of the clay pigeon, its direction and distance, as well as the trajectory of the pellets of the cartridge, direction, distance, and speed, so that both met at some point out over the lake. Now there I managed to score 2 out of 3. It was pretty good. Whereas in gunnery school, as I mentioned before, I had to do extra time because I was not so good with that particular gun. The next necessity at Rathmines, of course, was to form a crew. Fortunately, I was able to join Flight Sergeant Peter Bill's crew as second wireless operator. Now, the crew of the Catalina was made up of 9. There were 2 pilots, a navigator, 2 engineers, 2 wireless air gunners, an airframe fitter, and an armourer gunner. Now, there were other duties also for a wireless air gunner, and one was to operate a drogue to assist with the manoeuvring of the aircraft on the water. Now, a drogue is a conical canvas bag, but with a hole at both ends and attached to a very long rope. Now, with the aircraft moving on the water, if the pilot wanted to turn, say, to starboard, that is to the right, he would signal with 1 klaxon blast, and I would then throw out the drogue, and that would slow the aircraft on that side and turn it to the starboard. Another duty, of course, would be the mooring of the aircraft to a buoy. That required standing on a approximately 3-inch wide small ledge at the nose of the aircraft, lean over, hook the buoy with a boat hook, and then tie it to the buoy. There were a couple of other occasional duties. One was if the electric starter on the engines or motors, or donk if you prefer that term, was inoperative at the time, two airmen would have to scramble onto the top of the wing with a 5-foot crank, insert that down through a hole in the wing to engage an inertia wheel. Now, that was extremely difficult to turn the crank at first because of the weight of the inertia wheel. But once we got that up to speed, we then had to extract the crank, scramble down off the wing, signal the pilot so that he could operate his electrical starter. Now, a wireless air gunner would be stationed at any particular time either at the radio or at the radar set or in the blister where the gun was mounted. The radar was a particularly useful instrument. It was first developed shortly before the beginning of the war in Europe, and the system was that by sending out an extremely high frequency signal, that signal would be bounced back from any solid object in the air or the ground. That could be then measured by the receiver and calculated to a distance from the aircraft, which was shown by a trace on the monitor. That radar was particularly useful, for instance, in our first flight in the squadron, flying out northwest from Darwin towards the East Indies, which is now Indonesia. He asked what was the distance to the nearest island. I was able to answer instantly, 90 miles. And again later, with a more modern radar, in a mine-laying raid on Manila Harbour, our monitor showed that the bay that we were entering to lay our mines was only one-third the size of Manila Harbour, our selected target. Well, we very quickly got out of that bay, flew the few miles south to Manila Harbour, and laid our mine successfully. On the way out and back towards our advanced operational base, our navigator informed us we had started to fly into the Japanese naval base. And yet, in both those bays, we met no opposition at all that night. And in fact, for Manila Harbour, 22 Catalinas each laid two mines part of the time while the town lights were still on. Apparently the Japanese knew, could not understand what was happening, because two particular aircraft, one American, one Australian, were flying around the area dropping window. Now, window is pieces of aluminium foil thrown out in a goodly number, successfully jammed the Japanese radar so that they had no idea where the aircraft were at any given time. Our first mining operation in the squadron was from Cairns Base in North Queensland, where we laid our mines in a couple of harbours around the Celebes Island, also in Indonesia, of course. But in those flights, we were quite successful. No opposition, easily completed. But on our next mine-laying operation to Macassar Harbour, which is now known as Yujung Pandang, on the second night of laying the mines there, we received our one and only baptism of fire. I was stationed in the starboard blister as we started our mining run, and to see the trace of bullets, Japanese trace of bullets, coming up at us, that was rather frightening, knowing exactly what they were, but quite pretty actually, a little bit like fireworks. We were stationed at Cairns for only about a month before the whole base was moved over to Darwin, and then the rest of the squadron time was from Darwin, sometimes through an advanced operational base in King Sound, based on Cockatoo Island. That was a refuelling base there, and was useful for the mining of Japanese-held harbours in the East Indies. In the other mine-laying operations from Darwin, they were all routine, successfully completed, no opposition, returned to base, and most of the mine-laying operations required 17 hours, 11 hours of that at night, the other six late afternoon and early morning. The damage we sustained from Macassar was, first of all, six bullet holes in the hull, which needed to be plugged by our airframe fitter on the way back to Darwin. One bullet in the armourer gunner's buttocks, where it entered the low down on the buttocks and stopped just under the skin, up near the hip, without touching the bone. So I would say he was lucky and unlucky there. Now, one more bullet cut a communication cable inside the aircraft, and three others were found later in the fuel tanks. Without setting any fuel alight, or without causing any leak from the tanks. So there we were very lucky. But when the aircraft arrived in Australia from America, our mechanics and crews took out all the armour plating was removed from the aircraft, and officially we were told that the fuel tank lining were removed also.
Now, the mine laying mission into Darwin Harbour was the last one our crew did in 20 Squadron, and that was on the night of the 14th, 15th of December. Quite soon after that date, I was, after some leave at home, I was posted to an air sea rescue flight at Madang on the north coast of Papua New Guinea, number 111. And there we had amphibious Catalinas, that is, with retractable wheels. We operated from a short airstrip at not far from our camp there, Our camp was about a 12-foot square timber platform with a huge tent above it on the banks of the river. And there occasionally we enjoyed a course of cooked Red Emperor fish by throwing out a line at night, with baited line that is, and tied to the rail of the tent. Occasionally the next morning there'd be a fish on the line. Now there was I had a couple of amusing and one rather dramatic incident. Our second pilot, Dudley, decided he was going to teach me to drive. And of course this was in early 1945, which meant that by that time I was 23 and a half years old. So off we go. We start all right, driving back to our camp. There was a very short, rather steep, small hill to negotiate, and parked on the side of the road, just on the top of the slope, was an old Japanese truck with the extended sides. So not being never having driven before, I really had no idea quite what to do. I turned onto the top of the hill there rather sharply, and the high side of the truck I was being taught to drive in came inside the hood of the old Japanese truck. I stamped on the brake. I didn't know that I didn't realise that I had to also operate a clutch. Stalled the vehicle. Dudley decided I'd be a hopeless target. He never persevered. Second incident there was the fact that there was quite a long drive around the river to cross a bridge to get to the picture show screen that we visited quite a few times. I decided I'd like to go straight across the river, so I decided I would build a small lakatoi. Native lakatois were made usually out of tree trunk, carved out, with an outrigger on one side. I had got myself a piece of roofing iron, nailed a couple of bits of timber front and bent it first, nailed a couple of bits of timber front and back, cured a couple of more bits of timber and a large piece of light timber as a float, fixed those on the one side, and set off across the river. And about halfway over, down there, if the outrigger didn't break off the lakatoi, I was sitting on top, not in the well of the roofing iron, and of course the darn thing tipped over, tipped me into the water, boots and all. There I was rather lucky, treading water shore with difficulty. I was never a good swimmer. Unfortunately, a couple of other of our crew had a genuine native lakatoi. They picked me up and took me across to the other shore of the river. There you go. Now, while I was still at the 111 SE rescue flight, one particular flight we made was not an air search. It was to transport some roofing iron across to the Caribbean Islands somewhere. I've forgotten the actual town. But when we arrived there, we left someone else to organise unloading, and several of our crew wandered into the native village. And of course the natives always eager to get cigarettes from any airmen visiting the place, decided they'd do the Isiakwa dance for us. What that consisted of was four rather old hags. Well, they looked like hags to a 24-year-old young lad. All they were doing, of course, was shuffling in the dust and lifting the front of their grass skirts. Oh, yuck. Oh, I did that one. Now, after finishing at 111 Air Sea Rescue Flight at Madang, I was posted back to Brisbane to number 3 personnel depot at Sandgate, the seaside suburb of Brisbane. Whilst I was there, I quite often worked daytime in the rail transport office at South Brisbane Station. 15th of August, I remember there, was VP Day, that is the surrender of the Japanese. I was working in the RTO. We cheered like mad a little, then went back to work. From that particular phase of my service, I was then posted back to Rathmines. Rathmines again. On duty as a staff wireless operator, that was a wireless air gunner. And of course that meant no training lessons, just flights with various pilots whenever needed. In fact, the second entry in my flight log on that page after that date is the 2nd of November. So, and I've no idea what I did between the end of August and beginning of November, but never mind. We had two flights, both with the same pilot, of course. At this time, I was not flying with a crew. Our crew had already gone and dispersed to their own home states. But two flights from Rathmines via Cairns and Darwin were taking supplies to Balikpapan in Borneo and bringing back to Australia occupational Air Force guys. I have no idea now exactly how I filled in my time between flights there, but while there in December on the 8th, I took leave to marry a rather lovely lass by the name of Nolene Frances Couples, making it Noel and Nolene very nice.
Where did you meet her?
I met her first at Lynfield Railway Station in Sydney, and even then, as a rather shy lad, I, with two mates, posted a stage through Bradfield Park. We came off a train from the city at Lynfield Station. At the top of the stairs there happened to be a bookstall where a rather attractive young lady was serving. Now, my younger mate went over to the bookstall, chatted up this lass, and then called me over and introduced me. Then that young lady invited us home that evening for a sing-song around the map. Rather frequent pastime in those days for entertaining servicemen and women. that young lady, in fact, after years of correspondence, decided, yes, she would marry me. We were married at St. Martin's Anglican Church in Clara. Now, that particular weekend, there was a rail strike and a gas strike, which made life difficult to call evidence. And I had, because of that, and because it was expected anyway, I had booked over Saturday night at a hotel in the Glebe area of Sydney. When we got there, I found that we have a booking, and the other couple were already in the room that had been allocated to us. So the staff had to very hurriedly put a couple of single beds together in another room. That's how we spent the first night of our honeymoon. We had already arranged our honeymoon to be at this hotel on the beside the Pacific Highway, not on the highway, that would be rather difficult, at Kiama on the south coast of New South Wales. Now, my darling, being a somewhat fun lady, but very nicely so, enjoyed standing on the veranda, and as Navy trucks from Nowra passed by going north or south, she would always wave and cheer the Navy, that being because I was an Air Force. Now, unfortunately, before we were married, I'd arranged with my young mate at Rathmines to phone me, even at the honeymoon site, if and when I was rostered for duty. He didn't ring me, because he'd gone off and leave himself. So I had to race back to Rathmines after receiving a telegram to do so, and was confronted then the next day by our flight commander asking me where would I prefer a courts-martial or his punishment. Well, you can imagine which one I chose, his punishment, which meant I was duty officer for a week. The duties there of a duty officer were each evening to collect the cash from the messes and transfer them to the guardhouse safe. The other duty, of course, was to patrol inside the boundary fence twice a night, which meant that I slept in the guardhouse each day. Now, very soon after being posted to Rathmines this time, I had a couple of very enjoyable flights. They were both to Balikpapan in Borneo to take supplies across to Borneo via Cairns and Darwin, and to bring back occupation personnel in the Air Force from Balikpapan back to first time to Cairns, the second time to Rose Bay in Sydney. Now, another would it be amusing or pathetic event was when Nalene had found temporary accommodation in Toronto, which meant that I could go overnight there sometimes, or even some weekends, arriving there at lunchtime one Saturday afternoon to find that Nalene had just made a beautiful sponge cake, the first time in her life. And what does Noel do but stupidly pretends to drop the tape because it was so heavy. I didn't actually drop it, just pretended. But Marlene never, ever made another sponge cake. But she made beautiful milk chocolate Lamingtons for many, many years. Now, was at Rathmines, and 4 years after I applied for service in the Air Force, I was discharged at Redbank, another suburb in Brisbane. That was the 22nd of May, 1946. Now, after discharge, Nolan and I moved back to Lynfield in Sydney, and the first employment I found fairly soon after was in a Swiss engineer's house. His base, his garage and the external room above it were being used as a small factory, where he had been supplying instrument parts to the services, small instrument parts. And the first job I had, amazingly, was to break two weeny tiny pieces of steel wire in half. They were pivots for the instrument bearings, where both ends of say an eighth of an inch long piece of steel wire, about a tenth of an inch diameter, were rounded at each end on the lathe and grooved in the middle. I had to break those apart by the hundreds. But then, soon afterwards, it was decided that although that little factory was also making gramophone needles, that they would try to get into the new industry of radiogram needles. Our first efforts were to point, round the point, and polish agate pieces about the same size as those pivots were. And those would then be araldited into metal shanks. Now, we progressed from there, because it was found that actually agate was no harder than hardened steel of the gramophone needles, and it was decided to try sapphire. Now, to make the sapphire needles about the same size as that, we started off by importing half boule, that's spelled B-O-U-L-E, and in actual fact was rather like a stumpy thick carrot shape split down the middle. They were made in Switzerland by trickling aluminium oxide powder down through a very hot electric arc, where they collected like stalagmites on the bottom of the furnace. Now, once they cooled, if they were struck, a sharp blow on the pointy end would split right down the centre to make two halves. Now, using diamond impregnated discs, discs, we would cut slices in these half bills, say about 2/10 of an inch long, cut across the piece to make a small square piece out, to use our own measurements, about 10 thou. Now, thou is a thousandth of an inch, so they were quite small. We then araldited those pieces into aluminium stems with and then on a diamond impregnated wheel grind one end to a point, then put them on a polishing diamond wheel with about 5 micron diamond powder. Now a micron is a millionth of a meter, a thousandth of a millimeter, damn small. That point then was truncated on a diamond wheel again to give the flat pointed end. That pointed then, that needle was fitted onto a small machine that our instrument maker developed, where that metal stem with the sapphire point would be rotating and could be brought into and against a rubber canvas disc specially cut from industrial belting and impregnated with diamond powder. Now, if the needle was set at exact center height on the diamond disc, it would generate a rather pointy curved end. But by setting the height a little below center, depending on the skill of setting that height, would determine whether the point would then be a flattish oval point or a rather little sharpish oval point. Get it perfect and generate a beautiful semi-spherical point. That work was done by late teenage girls, actually, and they were quite skilled at that. I was acting there as the needle, I was charge hand in that small department in a factory at Hornsby. And even there, a rather amusing incident, an extension was being put on the rear end of the building, a reasonably sized brick exterior, about the size of an ordinary house, but straight. Now, our Swiss engineer boss and the foreman of the work on the extension were standing outside the rear wall of the extension while it was being just after it had been made, standing there conversing. All of a sudden the whole brick wall collapsed almost on top of them. From that radiogram needle manufacturing, I was later transferred to driving our manager's wife to and from her office in the city, because he unfortunately had died of a stroke just a short time earlier, and also driving her to her newly acquired property at Berrima, the old rectory which had been owned by the David Jones family. And that had originally, when it was first built, had been a staging hotel for the Coleman Co. coaches from Sydney to Melbourne. And I'll mention just of recent years when through the auspices of the librarian at Hornsby Council Library, I had found in the Vet Affairs newspaper a book that sounded interesting, being sold by an ex-serviceman in Darwin. I thought, oh, well, I'll go down to the library, see if they have a copy. And the librarian, when I did that and asked for the book, asked me for permission to give my name to the secretary of a Catalina Association. I said yes, and I was accepted for membership and have served in that association now for nearly 6 years, in recent times as membership secretary. As well as that, I now have an interest in the Catalina Flying Memorial Limited, whose founder was the person who arranged for a Catalina flying boat to be brought out to Australia to be purchased and brought out from Portugal to Australia. The first one of two was taken down to Albion Park, south of Wollongong, and is now nearly completely restored into wartime gear. The second is now at Bankstown. Both of those aircraft had before Australia and while in Portugal, had been firefighting equipment. They had huge water tanks inside the aircraft with a pickup tube available and a release valve available. And also, I am now, as an ex-serviceman who has served in Rathmines, doing this interview.